Chapter 7. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 10, 2010, 14 months before her death. Tom Jorgensen was a GWU professor of logic and critical thinking, and Becca knew what she was doing was wrong. Technically. In reality, she reasoned it was harmless, since she was no longer his student. There were no rules against students befriending professors, but the university had strict canons against professors engaging in inappropriate relations with students. The technicality, in Becca's mind, came from how one defined inappropriate. Many would argue that she and Tom could not date one another, as this would breach the trust all students place in professors. The counter-argument that they could date, since she was no longer his student, was what lawyers called a difference without distinction, a thought that made Becca cringe, since her mind was already working like her father's, and she hadn't even been accepted to law school yet. However she argued it, this rendezvous was just breakfast with an old professor who was leaving the university, and breakfast was better than getting drunk with him on rum and cokes, like she did earlier in the semester when they ran into each other at a bar in Foggy Bottom. There was the occasional text message sent back and forth, and a once-in-a-while coffee grab. If pressed, Becca would never deny that Tom Jorgensen was a good-looking man, and that she liked his attention. But she always paid her own way, and there was nothing illicit about the friendship. He was a 30-something-year-old, single, soon-to-be former GWU professor, who was on his way to New York. When friends leave, they say goodbye. "So, what's so great about New York?" Becca asked, as the waitress poured coffee. Tom shrugged.
"Cornell? It's beautiful and it pays better. Plus, you know, the status."
"Oh, come on. It's Ivy League. Since when have you been into status?"
"It's prestigious, that's all. I can't turn it down."
She took a sip of coffee. "Well, I'll be sad to see you go. I always liked spending time with you."
"You're one of my more unique students. And whether I left GWU or not, you're done after this year. So our paths were bound to diverge at some point."
"Maybe. I applied to GW Law, haven't heard yet, but if I get accepted, I might be sticking around." Tom shrugged.
"What if Cornell accepts you?"
Becca turned her head sideways. "How did you know I applied to Cornell?"
"You told me, a couple months ago when we met for coffee. Plus Harvard and Penn, so don't get so disgusted about me heading to an Ivy League school when you've applied to 3.
Becca smiled. She didn't remember this conversation, and she was certain only her parents and Gail knew all the law schools she applied to. "Fine. I'll cut you some slack about becoming an Ivy Leaguer. So what's the deal? When do you start?"
"Officially next year, but I'll be done here after this semester. I'll have an office at Cornell, where I'll be preparing for my class, which starts fall semester next year. I'm required to publish, too, so I'll be working on that most of the spring semester."
"So you have a semester to do nothing?"
"No teaching and no students. Lots of paperwork and research."
The waitress walked over with their plates and refilled their coffee.
"So listen," Tom said, as he forked his sausage and eggs. "I was thinking, since I'll no longer be employed by the university in a week or so, maybe you and I could actually go have a meal without worrying about being seen together."
Becca stopped cutting her omelet and stared at her plate for a second. "What do you mean? We're having breakfast right now."
"Yeah, and we're both sitting here worried someone might see us, worried we're doing something wrong. It would be nice if we could spend some time together without that fear hanging over our heads. No?"
Becca's eyes widened. "No, yeah, I mean, that would be fun. I guess I'm always a little worried about getting in trouble when we hang out. Although I think, really, you get in more trouble than I would."
"Exactly. So what do you say?"
"I've got finals next week. Then I'm going home for Christmas. Won't you be gone by the time I get back?"
"I'll be moving, but not gone. I won't be leaving until the end of January, so I'll be in town for a while. We could get together when you get back from break."
"Okay," Becca said. "It'll be our farewell dinner."
"That sounds awful, like we're never going to see each other again."
Becca smiled. Professor Jorgensen had a crush. "You're right. Our paths will cross again at some point, she lied. Because unless she was accepted to Cornell, which was unlikely, she would probably never see Tom Jorgensen once he left GWU. They picked a Friday night, and much deliberation was applied to the strategy. Fridays saw less students on campus, as most were out at bars, and some traveled home, and there was very little chance a professor would be anywhere near Sampson Hall. But most importantly, no one, professors, students, cleaning crews, would be back in the building until Monday morning, which granted time to fix any problems should something go wrong. It was midnight, and cold, when Brad inserted the mysterious key into the lock on the side entrance to the building, an entrance meant only for faculty. He smiled when the door clicked open. "Son of a bitch," Jack said. His breath floated from his mouth in a white whisper that rode on the Potomac breeze and swirled around them.
"You didn't expect it to work?" Brad asked. "I don't know what I expected." "No turning back now, Jackie boy." "This is truly crazy."
Jack grabbed Brad's shoulder before they walked through the door.
"Are you sure you want to do this? Becca's going to be fine for the final. She doesn't need the friggin' test."
"Let's go, Jack. Stop stalling."
The hallways were dark, lighted only by auxiliary bulbs in the corners and an odd fluorescent light that remained permanently glowing. The floors shined, reflecting the subtle lights and smelling from fresh lemon wax. An hour earlier, Jack and Brad watched the last of the cleaning crew leave. They walked the hallways of the building now, looking in each lecture hall and behind any unlocked doors, making sure the building was empty. To be caught in the building after hours on a Friday night was no crime. There was a bulletin board that attracted students at all hours and offered the latest news on updates and schedule changes and essay questions from the previous week. That was their cover should they be caught. They were in the building to get info from the mob board. The excuse was thin for a Friday night, but irrefutable should they need to present it to anyone in authority. After 20 minutes of searching, they agreed the building was empty. They entered the wing of professors' offices, a straight hallway with opposing doors, each littered with the instructor's signature beliefs or favorite quotes. Some were entirely empty but for the placard that gave their name. Others looked like the refrigerator of a household with five grade schoolers. As they approached the door of interest, its placard stated, "Professor Milford Morton." Underneath was a cartoon of the president on all fours in a pig pen. The caption read, "Once you step in it, you may as well roll around a while." Brad looked at Jack.
"I hope that's not metaphorical."
Jack shrugged as he looked at the cartoon.
"We haven't stepped in anything yet."
"We're about to step, roll, and dunk our heads. But it's us. We don't get dirty."
They lifted surgical gloves from the medical school's anatomy lab earlier in the week and slipped their hands into them. Neither had ever been arrested, and fingerprinting was not part of the enrollment process at GWU, but such precautions felt like the right thing to do. At the very least, it filled them with a needed boost of adrenaline. The key worked a second time, and Professor Morton's door opened without problem.
"Holy shit, Jack. We're really doing this. Let's kiss and hug later. Find the damn test."
With a small flashlight, they scoured the file cabinet in the corner and found in the third drawer a series of folders titled "Final Exam, Hard Copy." There was a copy for each of the last 6 years. With shaking hands, they each took three packets and skimmed them, quickly deducing there was very little difference between them, aside from the essay questions at the end. They laid them all on the desk. Brad worked the camera on his cell phone while Jack turned the pages. They took photos of each of the 8 pages of the latest test and all the essay questions from the past 6 years. Brad checked to make sure the quality was acceptable and the questions legible. 17 minutes after they entered the office, they closed and locked the door behind them, threw the surgical gloves in a garbage can, and walked in the shadows along the side of the building and eventually out into the campus. Their hearts were racing and their hands trembled. It was cold and dark, 2 weeks before Christmas break. They never spotted a soul until they were 3 blocks away from Sampson Hall, when they saw a freshman couple, holding hands and heading back to the dorms. They were invisible.
So what was the big mystery last night? Becca asked. They sat in a booth at Founding Farmers and drank coffee while they waited for their breakfast.
You had your little sorority thing, Brad said. We had our little thing.
Oh, Becca said. She looked at Gail. They're jealous.
Brad laughed. Jealous of what?
Our hookups last night, Gail said. Out late and now up early, Becca had her blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail. She wore no makeup besides the gloss that coated her full lips, which curled into a smile at Gail's tease. She looked, in her heavy GWU sweatshirt, both cute and stunning in the same glance.
You guys hooked up? Brad said with a smile. With Sig Epps?
Jack sat back in his chair and smiled while he sipped coffee. He looked at Becca over the edge of his cup. When she met his gaze, he slitted his eyes.
Are you listening to this? Brad asked. Listening, processing, storing, Jack said, sipping more coffee.
Time out, Gail said. What's the problem if I hook up with someone? I'm not dating either of you. And he was kind of cute, Becca said, finally looking away from Jack. For a Sig Epp.
Shut up, Gail said.
No, I'm serious. He just sort of had the man boob thing going, but if he hit the gym, he could take care of that.
This got Jack laughing, but Brad was still serious. So you guys really did hook up? Brad asked. Now he was staring at Becca. Becca pointed to Gail.
I went to bed after the social. Cinderella here strolled in at about 3 this morning. Gail tried to hide behind her coffee mug. Jack was still leaning back in his chair.
I heard that's the hardest place to lose weight. For a guy? In the chest.
Gail put her cup down. Stop it.
I'm not kidding. It's called gynecomastia. Large breasts on a man. And you can't get rid of it through exercise because of metabolism or something. Read it in a fitness magazine. Men's Life, I think. Because of the way blood flows to the pectoral region, when you exercise, you'll lose cellulite from the stomach, hips, butt, just about everywhere before you lose it from the breast.
Gail rolled her eyes. Jack held up his hand.
Wait a minute, Gail. I'm making a serious point here.
Which is?
Jack's face was stoic. If this guy's about 20 now, with significant gynecomastia, I'm thinking if this works out between you two, by the time he's 30, he'll be wearing your bras.
This got the whole table laughing. And Gail put her hand over her eyes. His face was cute.
Sure it was, Jack said. I'm just telling you what to expect in a few years.
Okay, Becca said. So now you guys know how we spent our evening. I'll assume no one really wants the specifics on what happened with Gail from midnight till 3. So what did you guys do?
Not much, Brad said. Then he stopped and raised his finger. Oh. We did break into Promo's office and steal a copy of the final exam for next week.
No one talked for a minute. The waitress came and set plates in front of each of them, refilled their coffees, and walked away. Jack and Brad let the silence linger as they stabbed their food. Becca leaned forward and quieted her voice. You guys broke into Professor Morton's office? Jack winked at her. I don't know what that means, she said. Yes? No? Jack wiped his mouth and leaned back again with his coffee.
Yes.
Becca widened her eyes. No. Jack shrugged his shoulders and looked at Brad.
Told you they wouldn't believe us.
Gail shook her head. I don't believe you. Brad looked at Jack with wide eyes.
No faith in us, Jackie boy.
You're messing with us.
No, Jack said. While you were messing with a Sig Epp, we were securing A's for the four of us.
He took a sip of coffee.
You can thank us later.
Prove it, Gail said. Brad handed over his cell phone and went back to his eggs. Holy crap, Gail said, as she scrolled through the photos with Becca over her shoulder. How did you get this? Jack let Brad tell the story. He seemed more proud of it. Gail shook her head when Brad was done. How do we know it's the same test he'll give us? Jack took a bite of eggs.
We don't. But we looked back at the last several years of tests, Brad said.
They were all on hard copy in his file cabinet, and none was much different, except for the essay questions, so we took pictures of all those. So even if it's not exact, it should be pretty damn close. Brad looked at Becca. I told you I'd come through for you.
10 days later, the night before Milford Morton's final exam, Becca sat with Jack in the quiet reference section of the library where they often studied. Brad and Gail skipped out early. With a copy of the final exam, there was little for them to study. Becca and Jack sat at opposite desks, which were isolated by wooden cubicles and offered privacy. Becca stood and peeked over the top of the desk to look at what Jack was reading. An open textbook sat illuminated by the desk lamp, several handwritten notebook pages next to him.
You're not using the exam, are you? Becca asked.
Jack looked up. Hi, Nosy. How are you?
Come on, Jack. I'm not as dumb as you think. How long does it take to memorize a stolen test?
Jack leaned back and embarrassingly spread his hands to reveal his study material.
You caught me.
I don't get it. I mean, I get it. You don't want to cheat. I'm the same way, but don't have the willpower not to peek. Plus, the whole slow infusion process, or whatever you call it, is a lost art on me. But why take the risk? Why break into Morton's office if you're not going to use the test?
Jack shrugged. Brad got the key. He was excited. It got me excited. I don't know. I guess I wanted the adventure.
He laughed.
I don't really know why I did it. I guess so when we're 50, we can tell good stories.
You don't even want to take a peek at the questions?
I don't need to.
Oh, Becca said, placing her hand over her heart. That hurts, right in my ego.
Jack smiled. I don't think you really need it either, but that's another story.
He waved his hand.
So what was the deal with you yesterday? Gail said you were upset about something.
Oh, just girl stuff.
You don't get girl stuff problems. Fess up.
Richard stopped by.
Again? That guy's an idiot.
Becca didn't say anything.
Have you asked him to leave you alone?
We're friends, Jack, and our parents are friends. I can't ask him to leave me alone.
First of all, he's not your friend. He's your ex-boyfriend. Second, your parents should support you on this. Every time this shithead comes around, you're upset for 2 days. Plus, it's finals week. So what's the jackass doing here?
Harvard finished last week and he was driving home. Just stopped by.
Knowing you'd be upset for the rest of the week when you need to study. I've had it with this guy.
It's fine, Jack.
What did he want this time?
Wants to get together over Christmas break.
Great. I hope you said no.
I told him I was busy. Hurry up and finish cramming. I'm getting tired. Becca sat back down behind her desk, out of sight. She put her head on her folded hands and closed her eyes.
I'm going to be another hour or so,
Jack said. I'll wait. Chapter 8. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 7th, 2012. Day 3. Millie's Coffee House sat on the corner of Maple Street and Tomahawk and was the only game in town for custom brews and homemade pastries. Set toward the south end of town, across from St. Patrick's Church, the corner location featured a cobblestone patio scattered with umbrellaed tables in front of a glass facade. Inside, the smell of coffee and sweets filled the air. Kelsey also noticed the subtle aroma of pine wood burning in the fireplace, holding off the final remnants of winter that refused to release their grip on the first part of March. Large and welcoming, the cafe was decked in deep cherry wood, from the baseboards to the thick ceiling beams. A red brick, dual-sided fireplace sat in the middle of the coffee house, with four leather chairs around it. Tall pub tables hugged the windows, while traditional cafe-style tables took up the floor plan. A shiny mahogany bar ran along the back wall, behind which employees donned red aprons while they whipped up coffee orders and dropped pastries onto plates for waiting customers. At the corner of the bar, a small group was in an animated discussion. When Kelsey heard Becca's name, she sat down two stools away and randomly scrolled through her phone while she listened. An older orange-haired woman, who Kelsey quickly noticed spoke with her eyes closed, sounded like she was on the defensive.
"That's not what I heard," Red said, eyes closed and shaking her head. "I heard she dropped out of school and was up here in Summit Lake for 2 weeks before that night."
"No, no, no,"
a younger man, mid-40s, said.
"Where do you hear this stuff? She never dropped out of school. She came here specifically to study for an exam. She came here the same day she was killed, so someone obviously followed her. The question is who?"
"Maybe some psycho spotted her on the road, you know?" This from a heavyset woman at the end of the bar. "Saw she was all alone and decided to follow her."
"Too random," the 40-year-old said.
"Not impossible, but, I mean, how would the guy know where she was going, or that she wasn't headed to meet someone else? Just too random."
"Well, that's what the police are saying. Some stranger broke in and robbed the house blind. Killed Becca by accident."
"In this whole town, a random stranger picked a random house that Becca was randomly in on a random night when she would normally have been at school?" The 40-year-old shook his head.
"I'm sorry, but that's too random."
"I still think it had to do with the girl dropping out of school," Red said. The group let out a collective sigh.
Listening for only a minute, Kelsey realized how far she'd gotten in just a couple of days. As she put her phone away, Kelsey recognized the girl who walked from the kitchen behind the bar. She watched the Morning Falls with her yesterday. The girl delivered a breakfast sandwich to a waiting customer and greeted two others before she made her way back behind the mahogany bar. Pretty, in that young way that took no effort, she had a bright smile that was perfect for a coffee house tucked into the mountains. With short, sandy hair, dimpled cheeks, and magnetism about her, it was easy for Kelsey to imagine this girl as the face of the establishment.
"Hi," Kelsey said. The girl looked surprised to see her.
"Hey," she said. "How are you?"
"Good. Ray, right?"
"Right. Welcome. What can I make you?"
Kelsey glanced at the list of coffees on the wall behind Ray.
"Caramel latte."
"Are you drinking this here or taking it to go?"
"Here."
Ray glanced over the gossip group.
"Take a seat by the fireplace," Ray said. "I'll bring it over."
Kelsey moved from the bar and sat in one of the overstuffed leather chairs, then pulled out her notes on the Eckersley case. She scanned them as she waited for her coffee. Her research so far told her Becca Eckersley was a good kid from North Carolina who'd attended George Washington University on a partial academic scholarship and who'd elbowed her way into the law school of the same university. Straight as an arrow, never in trouble, and a thriving first-year law school student when she was killed 2 weeks ago. Kelsey thought back to her conversation with Commander Ferguson and wondered what sort of trouble Becca was in before she was killed and what exactly a young law student might be hiding. From Commander Ferguson's case file, Kelsey created a timeline of the day Becca was killed, from the time she left GWU in Washington, D.C., to when she arrived in Summit Lake, to when she settled into her parents' house on Stilt Row. Sometime that day, Becca came here, to this cafe. Ray delivered her latte and sat in the chair next to Kelsey.
"I'm glad you came by," she said.
Kelsey took a sip.
"I can't turn down a coffee invitation. I love this place. It's beautiful. Feels perfect for this town."
Ray smiled.
"It's a popular attraction for sure."
"How long have you worked here?"
"A while. I run the place now since Livy wanted a break. She's the owner."
"Yeah?
I was actually hoping to talk to the owner for my article."
Ray made an "I'm sorry" face.
"That would be Livy Houston. She's hardly ever around anymore. Comes in occasionally, but not much, and not at all since Becca was killed."
"Why?"
"It was too much for her. Police were asking her questions, then customers too. Some detectives showed up from down south. It was too much."
"Are you here a lot?"
"Every day now."
"Were you here the day Becca Eckersley was killed?"
Ray nodded. "I was."
"Did you see her here?"
"Yeah."
"Talk to her?"
"No."
"Did Mrs. Houston?"
"Yeah, they talked for a while. Livy is friends with Becca's parents."
The police chief thinks Libby Houston might have been the last person to talk to Becca before she was killed.
From what I know, Ray said, she was. But if you want to talk with Libby, you won't find her here. She's fallen off the map since Becca was killed. She lives here in town, though. West Side in the foothills. You could try making a house call. Not sure she'll talk to you, though.
Kelsey pulled out her notepad and wrote down Libby Houston's name.
Anything you can tell me about that day? About Becca?
Not much, Ray said. I was working in the kitchen, and it was pretty slow, so I wasn't out here much.
You know most of the customers?
Sure. Know their faces anyway. Most of their names. Except on the weekends, we get a lot of out-of-towners.
You remember anyone from the day Becca was killed who stands out to you?
Ray thought a minute. Not really. No one I can think of. It was just a normal Friday.
How long was Becca here that day?
Couple hours at least. She was working on a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, studying for a law school exam. You see anyone other than Libby talk to her?
No. From what I remember, she came in alone and left the same way.
Kelsey paused, looking at her notes and taking a sip of coffee.
Okay. You mind if I come back to talk to you about that day, if I need anything else?
Yeah, sure.
Ray pointed to the gossip group at the bar. Everyone who comes in here talks about it. The regulars sip lattes and splash gossip around every morning, and they all have their own theories about what happened to Becca. Some of it's pretty wild.
Ray smiled. You're welcome to join the conversation any morning.
Thanks, Kelsey said, and thanks for the coffee.
Good luck.
It was 4 blocks to the Winchester Hotel, and then another quarter mile until she reached the hospital grounds north of the town center. The hospital sat on the banks of Summit Lake, and the automatic doors slid open when Kelsey approached the front entrance. At the reception desk, she made inquiries until she was directed to the 3rd floor, where she found the nurse's station.
Hi, Kelsey said. I'm looking for Dr. Peter Ambrose.
Sure, the nurse said. He should be in his office. Last door on the right.
The nurse pointed down the hallway. Kelsey smiled and headed down the corridor. When she reached the office, the door was open, and she knocked on the frame. Peter Ambrose was sitting behind the desk, paging through charts and typing on his computer. He wore blue surgical scrubs and a long white coat that had his name stenciled on the breast pocket. A nice-looking man with short cropped hair and sideburns that bled into the shadow of scruff across his face, he had an all-American look. Kelsey could imagine him as the valedictorian of his high school class, or the bowman of the Yale crew team, where he studied. Kelsey had done a little research into Dr. Ambrose. She always did some picking before she asked someone for help. He looked up.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Ambrose?
Yeah?
My name's Kelsey Castle. They told me downstairs you might be able to help me.
He cleared a space on the desk by stacking charts to the side, then pulled the surgical cap from his head.
Come in.
He pointed to the chair.
What can I do for you?
I'm in town writing a story on the Becca Eckersley case. I write for Events Magazine. She handed Dr. Ambrose a card as she sat down.
Are you familiar with the case?
He studied her card for a moment.
Only because the girl was treated here. I wasn't directly involved.
I'm trying to get hold of Becca's autopsy and medical records from the night she was brought in. Is that something you can help me with?
Dr. Ambrose swiveled in his chair and threw his surgical cap into the trash.
I don't think so. Medical records are protected, so you'd have to get permission from the family.
That's not happening. The family is very private. They're not going to allow me to look at the records.
Without their approval, I'm not sure there's much I can do for you.
She paused for a moment. You have full access, though, right? To the medical records?
Sure, if I wanted to look.
Do you want to look?
Dr. Ambrose smiled.
I told you, I wasn't the treating physician, so I have no reason to look.
What if I told you I thought things were missed? I just need help getting my hands on some of this information, and I know I'd be able to piece a few things together.
Isn't this an active investigation?
It is.
Why don't you just let the police piece it together?
They're trying.
And you're going to do a better job than the police,
Not better, just different. Homicides are solved all the time when new eyes look at old evidence.
I bet that's accurate.
But again, I'd have to get permission from the family before I could hand anything over to you. Kelsey nodded. Okay, I understand.
Why don't you talk to the family? You might be surprised.
Maybe, Kelsey said as she stood up. Thanks for your time.
What's the interest?
Dr. Ambrose asked as she was leaving. Kelsey turned in the doorway. With a runner's body and big caramel eyes, Kelsey knew how to use her presence to get her point across. First and only murder in Summit Lake. Prominent family. Young law student with everything going for her. Squeaky clean and straight as an arrow. State authorities have taken the case from the local boys because this story stinks, and someone wants something buried and hidden. It's exactly what my magazine publishes, and the type of thing I'm really good at figuring out. She shrugged. Thanks again for your time. Kelsey stepped into the corridor.
Stinks of what?
A cover-up.
You know her,
Dr. Ambrose asked.
Who? The victim.
No, but the little I've learned about her makes me think something's off with the whole story and the current police theory.
Which is?
That a stranger broke into her house, assaulted her, and fled into the night without anyone seeing a thing.
Sounds flimsy.
And lazy, Kelsey said. He ran a hand over his chin as he thought.
Who's covering things up?
I don't know.
And why would someone hide details of a young law student's death?
Good question.
You think my hospital is involved? My staff? That's ridiculous.
I don't know who's involved, Dr. Ambrose. I'm not making accusations. I'm looking for answers. And I need some help finding them. He rubbed his hands together, finally folding them on the desk as if in prayer, then checked his watch.
How about this? I have to round on some patients this afternoon. Then I'll poke around and see what I come up with. I can't get you any records or documents, but I can quietly read through what's available and tell you what I find.
You do that for me?
I'll do it for myself. Now I'm curious.
Thank you.
Give me a day to see what I can come up with. Let's get together tomorrow night.
Kelsey nodded. Perfect.
There's a place called Water's Edge, just off Tahoma Avenue.
7?
That works.
Kelsey smiled. Thanks for your help.
I haven't done anything yet.
She waved goodbye and rode the elevator to the ground floor, mentally checking off items on her to-do list. This was what early field work looked like. She talked to many people and started down several avenues of discovery. Some she knew would run off to dead ends, and others would lead to more information that required further investigation. But if enough trails were started, Kelsey knew one of them would lead somewhere important. Chapter 9. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 21st, 2010, 14 months before her death. December in the District of Columbia was bitter, with winds off the Potomac that ran up your back and into your spine. Becca pulled her scarf to her eyes and jogged to Old Main for her last exam before Christmas break. Butterflies floated in her stomach, not from fear of Professor Morton's final exam and whether it would resemble the stolen test she had memorized, but instead from the anticipation of what waited after this semester. She harbored her feelings for 3 years, keeping them secretly stowed, sharing them with no one, not even Gail. But now she finally decided to unlock those feelings and put them on display. There would be some explaining to do, and perhaps some awkward days or weeks ahead. They would pass, though. And if they didn't, graduation was on the other side of winter, not 6 months away. The confines of the social circle she constructed around herself would no longer limit her. And if friendships faded, Becca would assume it was the way life after college worked. In the world that waited outside George Washington University, secrecy about the man she loved would play no role. It took 3 years of friendship to lay the groundwork, and on such strong footing, it was not hard to understand how she fell so far so fast. Now she was 2 hours from finishing her 7th semester. Only one left after this, and Becca wondered where that semester would lead. She envisioned happiness and bliss, and finally holding his hand during strolls through campus, Saturday morning breakfasts, which they currently could only enjoy when they snuck out of Foggy Bottom and found a deserted cafe, could be enjoyed openly, like any other couple. She was tired of lying to Gail, and it was definitely time to stop sneaking herself out of his bed early in the morning before the campus woke. As she jogged to Professor Morton's exam, her stomach continued to stir. The butterflies grew more intense as she imagined the coming year. The campus thinned during the 10 days that constituted finals week as students scribbled their exams and left for home. Only the unluckiest of students had to wait until the last morning for their freedom. Most were done the day before and well into Christmas break by that night, which was something of an event around campus, a sayonara to the semester of hard work. And for Becca Eckersley and her three friends, it was a final passage, the last time they would celebrate the end of a semester and the coming break. It was the end of an era. Next time this happened, they would be at the end of their college careers. There would be no breaks in front of them, except for the summer before law school, which was likely to scatter them across the country. They met at the 19th, which was filled with GWU students and a few young professors who wore turtlenecks under elbow-patched sport coats. Becca and her friends sat at a tall, round table for four, a pitcher of beer half spent and their glasses filled.
"It was exact, am I right?" Brad asked.
Gail gave a little smile. "Exact, exact. Like, no differences at all." Becca took a sip of beer. "I have to admit, Brad, you delivered in the clutch." Brad mimicked a high-pitched female voice.
"I'll still love you when you don't come through."
"Okay, okay. You came through for once, and we all owe you everything we have in school and life and in our future careers."
"I wouldn't go that far," Brad said.
He looked up in contemplation.
"Actually, that's pretty right on. Do you have anything else to add?"
"I do," Jack said. "For a 2-hour exam, it would have looked a little better had you not finished in 30 minutes.
Brad laughed. "I know, right? I was the first one out of there, and then it was like an avalanche."
Gail laughed. "People bolted as soon as you stood up. It was like everyone was waiting for the first person to commit." Becca laughed along with Gail, but saw the concern in Jack's eyes.
"How many people had the damn thing?" Jack asked.
He made a circular motion with his fingers.
"I thought this was our little secret."
"I gave it to a couple buddies,"
Brad shrugged. "I'd say half," Becca said, considering how many people left early. Jack shook his head.
"Bradley, that's just a good way to broadcast that something's up."
"Come on, Morton wasn't even proctoring. It was the old guy from the library and that lady."
Brad snapped his fingers as he thought.
"From the admissions office or something. They don't know how long the test was supposed to take. That geeky kid, what's his name? With a half mullet?"
"Andrew Price," Becca said.
"Right. He's out of every exam in 30 minutes.
Jack poked a toothpick between his teeth.
"Not exams with essay questions at the end.
Trust me, if good old Promo had been in the room, I'd have stuck around for the full 2 hours. Which, by the way, was what you did. What's up with that? Were you that nervous about leaving early?"
Jack shrugged his shoulders and sipped his beer.
"Wanted to make it look good."
"You're a good actor, and you have a hell of a lot more patience than I do. I would have gone nuts just sitting there."
Jack looked at Becca.
"I just hope things stay contained, if you know what I mean. And I hope everyone you gave the test to had the sense to miss a few questions. A perfect score from 50 kids with C averages spells shit-canned city for us."
Brad knocked Jack's pint with his own, giving off a loud clink and splashing cheap beer onto the table.
"Cheers, brother. Stop stressing. In the next few weeks, we should all know where we're going to law school, and then it's smooth sailing. As long as you don't fail a course, the schools don't even look at your final semester. Now drink your beer and relax. We're on Christmas break."
"He's really freaked out, isn't he?" Brad asked.
Becca raised her eyebrows and shrugged. It didn't look good that everyone left so quickly. And in Jack's defense, I agree that maybe we should have just kept the test to the four of us.
Maybe, Brad said. But some guys knew I had the key to Morton's office, and I guess I didn't want it to look like I was too scared to do anything with it. Plus, the guys I gave it to really needed it. They were in bad shape going in, kind of like you.
Right. But like Jack said, if a bunch of kids with C's suddenly ace the final exam, people are going to suspect something.
I know one girl with a C who aced it, right?
Becca shrugged. Yes, it helped a lot. Took some pressure off. Jack and Gail had gone home early from the bar. Brad and Becca stayed and finished the pitcher before walking back to Becca's apartment. Gail was sound asleep, and Becca quietly closed her bedroom door. She and Brad sat in the living room, Becca lying on the couch with her bare feet on Brad's lap.
You know, I did it for you, Brad said.
Shush, Becca said. I don't want Gail to know you're here.
I don't care if Gail knows I'm here.
I just don't want her to wake up and come out here.
Okay, Brad said in an exaggeratedly hushed voice. You know I did it for you, he said again.
Did what?
Got the test. You said you really needed help.
Thank you, Becca said. I probably would have survived without it, but like I said, it took some pressure off.
Look how freaked out you are. You guys are overthinking this, and I'm getting a headache worrying about it.
Brad rubbed Becca's feet.
This reminds me of the good old days.
What do you mean? Brad didn't know how to tell her. Couldn't find the words to express how he felt about her. He knew she had similar feelings, and he was just about ready to ask her about them. Just about ready to let the words flow off his tongue. He thought many times of how that conversation would go. The, why did we wait so long to admit this? And, I'm so glad we don't have to hide this any longer. Slogans passed through his head when he imagined finally discussing his feelings with her. And now, here they were, and here it was. The moment when they could get it all out in the open. But he choked. For some reason, the words wouldn't form. What do you mean? Becca asked again. About the good old days. There were nights last year when he thought he was falling in love with her, but never found the courage to tell her, or even to kiss her again the way he had freshman year. His feelings brewed and simmered throughout junior year until summer break. Then they said goodbye. Tentative plans to get together over summer fell through, and it wasn't until the beginning of senior year that he finally got to see her again. By then, having missed her so badly, Brad knew without question he loved her. But the unspoken attraction and pent-up feelings worked against them during this past semester. The late nights of talking until the sun rose and until they both drifted off to sleep happened infrequently at the beginning of the semester, and barely ever now. A week before when she slept over, and now tonight, were the only times all semester Brad could remember having Becca just to himself. Brad? Becca said again. What's going on?
Finally pressed on the subject, and perhaps wanting to be, Brad felt his cheeks warm. I don't know. I guess I just miss this. He threw his finger back and forth. You know, you and me talking all night. We used to do it all the time. But this year has been weird for us. You know?
He saw Becca's eyes dart right and left as he spoke, recognizing that she felt the same way. She sat up and pulled her feet slowly from his lap. Brad, Becca said, you know you're one of my dearest friends, right?
Sure, Brad said. And you're one of mine.
So stop talking about the good old days, okay? What are we, old people? We're going to be friends forever.
I like hearing you say that, Brad said, because I like being friends with you, and I like being close to you, and I like spending all night talking to you, and those stupid BB notes you leave for me in the mornings mean a lot to me.
What notes?
The little sticky notes you write me when you stay over and leave before I'm awake. I don't know, I just like them.
He pointed toward Gail's bedroom.
And I don't care who knows that we like spending time together.
They weren't the words he had practiced so many times. He wanted to say that he loved her. He wanted to tell her that he couldn't imagine only being her friend for the rest of his life, because that would mean every woman he met would be compared to her, and he knew none would stack up. But even though the correct words did not form tonight, what came out was a good start. It was further than they ever came before in dealing with their feelings for each other.
"Everyone knows you and I are close," Becca said. "It's no secret."
"I know we're close, but my comment about the good old days comes from, I don't know. I just feel like something happened over the summer. Last year we used to stay up all night and talk, and we haven't had many of those nights this year. I miss them, that's all."
Becca moved her feet back onto his lap. "My flight doesn't leave until tomorrow afternoon. We can stay up and talk tonight. I'd like that."
Brad grabbed her feet and massaged them as they rested on his lap. This was a perfect way to end the semester, but Brad knew he couldn't go through another. Their last, hiding his feelings. The conversation eventually drifted to Brad's father. Becca was the best listener on the subject. Becca's father had been invited again to the Reynolds' hunting cabin for the annual weekend, where stiff-suited lawyers acted like outdoorsmen. Brad pressed for information about what Becca's father thought of his dad. Becca kept the fact that her dad thought Mr. Reynolds was a jagoff to herself, but the topic took them late into the night. The whole time they talked, Brad thought about kissing her, but the right moment never came. Later, he listened to Becca's breath as she slept next to him. Brad closed his eyes and imagined them as a couple. Next year would be different.
Chapter 10. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 8, 2012. Day 4. It took a few calls the next morning to find the address and phone number. It was late afternoon when the woman was able to meet. Kelsey walked from the Winchester Hotel and found Hiawatha Avenue. She sucked up the crisp spring air as she made her way west through town, toward the mountains. The houses here were older colonials with wraparound porches and manicured lawns. She found 632 painted on the mailbox, headed up the front steps, and rang the bell. It was her fourth day in Summit Lake. A moment later, an elderly woman came to the door with a pleasant smile.
"Hello?" the woman said.
"Hi, Livy?"
No, Livy's my daughter."
She had a cute southern twang covered by the gravel of age. "My name is Kelsey Castle. We spoke earlier on the phone?"
"Oh, yes, you're the writer."
"Correct, a journalist for Events Magazine."
"You gonna figure out what happened to Becca?"
the woman asked.
"I'm going to write a story about her, yes."
Through the screen door, Kelsey guessed the woman was in her 80s, maybe older. Her gray hair was recently sculpted, and Kelsey suspected she kept a weekly appointment at the beauty shop in town. Her skin had deep creases, but her smile was bright and her eyes sharp.
"Is your daughter home?" "Oh, no," the woman said. "She's gone now. Too many people asking her too many questions."
Kelsey paused a moment and slivered her eyes. "When I talked to you on the phone, you said she was here."
"No, ma'am. You asked if she lived here, and I told you she did. Had you asked if she were home, I'd have told you she was sick and tired of talking to y'all."
Kelsey smiled at the old lady's backhanded charm. "My apologies," she said. "I misunderstood. Mind if I ask you a few questions?"
"Of course not. No one's asked me a thing."
"I didn't get your name."
"Mildred Mays. But you can call me Millie. Everyone else does."
Kelsey smiled through the screen door.
"Millie? Like Millie's Coffee House?" "You got it. Started that little place many, many years ago."
"I was there yesterday. It's really pretty."
"Sure is. Livy did a great job remodeling when she took over."
"I understand Becca Eckersley was at the cafe that day." Kelsey paused. "The day she died. I heard Livy talk to her."
"It's such a shame," Millie said,
opening the screen door and motioning Kelsey inside.
Livy and her husband are close with William and Mary.
She turned to Kelsey as they walked through the hallway.
That's Becca's parents.
She pointed to a bar stool at the kitchen island.
Take a seat. I'll make some tea.
Kelsey sat down. Through the bay window was a spectacular panoramic view of the mountains.
This is a beautiful home, Kelsey said.
Thank you.
Millie set water on the stove to boil. She draped 3 Louisiane tea bags over the edge of the pot.
Some people enjoy the lake, like the Eckersleys, with that beautiful house on the water and that wonderful view. We prefer the mountains.
Both are nice options. Kelsey pulled her notepad from her purse.
Oh, sure. Only problem out here are the hunters. Lots of hunting cabins deeper in the foothills, and they make a hell of a racket some mornings, shooting those guns. But I'm an early riser, so it doesn't bother me much.
Kelsey waited for a moment. So, how was it that Livy knew Becca?
Livy lived in the same neighborhood as the Eckersleys, back in Greensboro. That was before she and Nicholas moved up here permanently. Nicholas is my son-in-law. Livy and Nicholas are the ones who introduced William and Mary to Summit Lake when their kids were very young. My husband and I have been up here for years. When I was ready to move on from the coffee house, it was Livy's turn to take over. Livy and Nicholas have owned a house here for many years, and they used to invite the Eckersleys up for long weekends when the kids were young. William and Mary fell in love with this town and soon bought the Stilt house. Livy has children the same age as Becca and her brother. She used to watch the Eckersley clan a bunch when they were little kids.
Watch them how?
William was always busy with his law practice, and Mary worked back then. Livy stayed at home, and her house back in Greensboro was where the kids gathered in the summer. Livy just took on the role of watching Becca and her brother when William and Mary were at work.
Have the Eckersleys been back up here since Becca died? To that Stilt house?
Oh, no. They rushed up the night it all happened, but after Becca died, the house was roped off. They stayed at the Winchester for a couple of nights to help the police any way they could. Then they went home to Greensboro and haven't been back since. I heard they're going to sell the house. They couldn't possibly enjoy it, knowing what happened there. I don't blame them one bit, but I doubt the house will sell easily, which is unusual for those homes. Whenever they go on the market, they're usually snatched up real quick because of their location and so forth. But this is a small town, and everyone knows what happened to Becca.
Kelsey made some notes while Millie pulled 2 tea glasses from the cabinet. Did Livy tell you she talked to Becca that day, at the coffee house, a few hours before she died?
Millie smiled as she worked. I'm her mother. Livy told me everything about that day.
In a softer voice, and with more twang, she added,
and plenty more.
The water came to a rolling boil, and Millie turned the burner off and covered the pot to let the tea simmer. She pulled a glass pitcher from the fridge. It was empty, but for a strange sludge at the bottom, which was barely visible through the frosted glass.
I found if you chill this overnight, it sticks to the tea better.
Millie swirled the concoction in the pitcher.
What is it? My special recipe for sweet tea.
Millie placed the pitcher next to the brewing tea.
You tell me what you think when it's ready.
Can't wait, Kelsey said. Can you tell me anything about Livy's conversation with Becca that day at the cafe?
Oh, sure. I can tell you all about it. Becca came to Summit Lake to study for her exams. She was studying to be a lawyer, you know.
She was at George Washington Law, isn't that right? This caused Millie to laugh.
For her father, there was no other choice. It was his alma mater, and he was intensely proud of his school. Becca's brother attended a few years before she did, and then joined his father's firm.
That was the plan for Becca, I suppose.
How long was she at the cafe that day?
Couple of hours, from what Livy said. She had papers and books all over the place. On the table, on the chairs, a real mess. Had her computer out and was tapping along. Libby didn't want to bother her or take her focus off her studies, so mostly she just let Becca work. Refilled her coffee when she asked for more.
When they finally did talk, what did Libby say they talked about?
After she packed up her things, Libby walked over to say hello. Becca was always a good girl, real polite. Livy asked her about school, and Becca showed her what she was reading. Real boring stuff. Constitutional law that sounded awful to cram in your brain. And contracts, too. Millie shook her head. But Becca said she liked it, so Livy was excited for her. You've got to remember, Livy used to babysit this girl when she was still in diapers. So to see her studying to be a lawyer was a real treat. Livy told me, though, she could tell something was wrong. Something about Becca was off.
Like what?
She looked worried, I guess. Livy never really explained it. She's just good at reading people. You know someone from the time they were a little girl, you can tell when something's bothering them.
Livy asked her about it?
Millie paused before answering. She did.
And?
Well, you see, Miss Castle, Livy never told William and Mary about this because Becca swore her to secrecy. So I'm not sure she'd want me to say anything to you.
A veteran at conducting interviews, Kelsey knew when to push hard for information and when to back off. When Millie offered nothing more, Kelsey scribbled on her notepad and changed the subject.
Has Livy been in touch with the Eckersleys since Becca died?
Not that I know of. Livy and Nicholas are up here most of the year running the coffee house, and since the kids have all gone off to college, she hasn't been as close to William and Mary. She sent a card and saw them at the funeral, but hasn't talked to them besides that. Plus, William and Mary have been busy with the investigation.
Millie stood and walked to the stove. She poured the hot tea into the frosted pitcher and stirred it thoroughly to dissolve the sweet sludge at the bottom. From an ice maker near the kitchen bar, she scooped 2 shovelfuls of ice into the pitcher. After some more stirring, she made herself a sample and examined it as if she were in a Napa vineyard. Finally, she tasted it, staring through the bay window while she let her palate examine her work. Then she nodded.
Perfect.
She filled 2 glasses and placed one in front of Kelsey.
See for yourself.
Kelsey took a sip. Raised in Florida, she was no stranger to sweet tea, and Kelsey had to admit that Millie's sludge put a taste on the tea that was different from anything she'd experienced before.
Very good. Isn't it? I'm quite proud of it.
Kelsey took another sip. This might be the best tea I've ever tasted. You should sell this.
I do, over at the coffee house. It's on the menu. Millie's Sweet Tea.
Her southern twang was more pronounced with some tea on her tongue.
No kidding. When I owned the place, I had a few customers ask for it every now and then, but I never told many people about it. But when that young girl came to run the place for Livy, she liked the tea so much she put it on the menu and named it after me.
Who's that?
The young girl who's running the cafe while Livy's gone.
Ray?
Yes, nice girl. You know her?
I met her the other day, Kelsey said.
Great girl. Sharp as a nail, too. Everybody really likes her around this town. After she put my name on the menu, she'll always have a place in my heart.
Millie walked over to the counter and gathered the ingredients to put them away. She shoved the laminated page containing her sweet tea recipe into a binder.
Is your recipe available to the public? Kelsey asked.
Oh, no, sweetheart, Millie said, holding up her recipe binder, a felt-covered book that rested on her counter. This book is strictly off-limits.
If I let people know what was in here, all my secrets would be revealed. I'm 86 years old. My secrets are all I have left.
Kelsey nodded and drank her tea, staying quiet for a moment. She looked over her notes before deciding enough time had passed. Any hint about what was on Becca's mind that day at the cafe? What might have been bothering her? You said she swore Livy to secrecy about something. Millie sighed. She shoved her recipe book into a row of cookbooks on the kitchen counter and then sat down with Kelsey. She took a sip of tea, looked at Kelsey with a little smile.
She was excited about a boy she was dating.
Kelsey scribbled again on her notepad. Did she tell Livy anything about this boy?
Quite a bit. When Livy finally went over to talk to her, after Becca gathered up her study materials and textbooks, she was scribbling away in her journal. Livy said she was gushing.
Kelsey's spine straightened and her eyes narrowed. Becca was writing in a journal?
That's what Livy told me.
Did Livy see the journal?
Just what Becca showed her about the boyfriend.
Which was?
He was someone from law school, or maybe he was already a lawyer. I guess I'm not too sure about that. I just remember Livy saying Becca was really glowing about him and...
Millie trailed off. And what? Kelsey asked.
Well, you see, I feel strange telling you this because Becca's parents don't even know. Even now, I don't think they know. Becca never told them.
Told them what? That she was dating this guy?
Oh, no. Her parents knew she was dating him.
Then what? Millie wrapped both hands around her tea and closed her eyes.
They didn't know. Becca had gone off and married this fella.
Chapter 11. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, December 22nd, 2010, 14 months before her death. Jack slammed the back hatch of the Ford Explorer and walked to the driver's side window.
See you, buddy. Have a good Christmas.
Yeah, Brad said. Brad stared straight through the windshield, and Jack recognized the familiar look in his roommate's eyes. He always noticed it when Brad headed home.
It won't be that bad, Jack said. Just don't get into it with him.
Brad feigned a smile.
He's such a pompous ass. I can't wait until I'm on my own. He already told you he's not paying for law school, so there you go. Get an apartment next year and borrow your way to freedom. That's what student loans are for. You can spend every holiday at my place.
Jack leaned against the car, his breath a swirling white vapor as it came from his mouth.
Where will your place be? Brad asked. Next year? Depends where I get accepted. How about Becca? She here from any schools yet? I don't think so. I haven't really talked to her about it. Jack laughed. Don't worry about Becca and where she's going next year. You get like this every time you head home. Like what? Freaked out about everything. Listen, in 10 years, you and your old man might be best friends, so just grin and bear it for one more Christmas. Aren't you heading down to Florida anyway, to hang with Gail? Yeah, maybe. Let's get a beer before I leave. You're not drinking beer before you drive 100 miles. Fine, let's get a burger. What's up with you? Your old man is a pain in the ass, but I've never seen you so messed up. Is it about Morton's final? I've got to tell you something, and it's going to screw everything up.
Jack stared into the car and checked his watch.
Okay, let's get lunch.
They drove to McFadden's and found a booth in the back. Boise State was playing Utah in a college bowl game, and several flat-screen televisions displayed the action. They ordered burgers and Cokes and stared at each other for a while, half watching the game until their food arrived.
You're weirding me out, man, Jack finally said. Spit it out. What's on your mind?
Brad took a swallow of Coke and washed down his burger.
Okay, here's the deal. I think I'm in love with Becca.
Jack's forehead wrinkled and his eyebrows slowly elevated.
What?
Brad nodded.
It's totally screwed up, I know, but I needed to tell you. I want your advice.
On what? Jack shook his head.
Say it again. I love her. I'm in love with her.
Okay, slow down, Brad. You're not in love with Becca.
Don't say that to me, Jack. You don't know what's been going on between us. I'm telling you, I've had these feelings for a long time.
How can you be in love with someone you've never dated, or kissed, or slept with? Maybe infatuated, but not in love.
Whatever, it's complicated. We're really close. She stays over all the time, and we talk until the sun comes up. I never told you about it because it's a private thing between us. We went through a strange period where we stopped the sleepovers, whatever you want to call them. But lately, the last couple of weeks, we're back at it. You know, we just talk all night. Last night we had this thing, I don't know, like a moment. Like we were about to tell each other how we felt. I know she feels the same way about me, but it'd be too complicated if we got together, you know? Neither of us knows where we'll be next year. We're friends, and she doesn't want to screw that up.
Brad stirred his Coke with a straw.
I just wanted to give you a heads up. My mind is spinning right now.
Jack shook his head.
Give me a heads up on what? You know, with the four of us all being friends, I think we both feel like it would screw things up, Becca and me, if we got together. But I don't really care about that anymore. I hope it doesn't bother you if Becca and I become, you know, start dating.
Slow down for a second. Jack looked at his friend.
Did Becca tell you she felt the same way? That she wants to get together with you? Or date you, or that she loves you?
No, I mean, not exactly. She tells me she loves me all the time, but she says that to everyone. I think she's worried about the dynamics of our little group if she and I get together.
Jack thought for a second.
You've got a lot going on, okay? You're emotional about going home and dealing with your asshole father. You're waiting to find out about law school. Maybe a little freaked out about next year. You just got done with finals and the whole Professor Morton thing. It all piles up.
None of that matters. Brad shook his head. I can stay up until dawn talking to her, and she totally understands what I'm going through with my father. She just, I don't know, she just listens to me and understands me. She's perfect for me, and I know we'd be perfect together.
What if Becca doesn't feel the same way?
I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I know she does. I guess I'm going to find out anyway.
How?
Brad shrugged. I'm gonna tell her. Wait until we get back from break and then tell her how I feel.
They finished their burgers and pretended to watch the bowl game.
Okay, Jack said. Let things simmer for a couple weeks. We'll talk after Christmas.
Yeah, Brad said. What time's your flight?
Jack checked his watch.
Soon. I've got to run.
They drove back to their apartment, and Brad stopped in the parking lot.
I better hit the road. Have a good flight. And say hi to your parents.
I will, Jack said.
Be nice to your old man. Maybe he's mellowed since Thanksgiving.
Jack stepped out of the car and held the door open.
See you in a couple weeks, Brad said.
All right.
Jack closed the door and Brad backed into the street. The driver's side window was open.
Hey, Brad, Jack yelled from the parking lot. Don't sweat it. This stuff has a way of working out.
Brad waved and rolled the window up as he drove away. Jack watched his roommate cruise down H Street, past the cathedral buildings the campus was famous for, and then onto the boulevard that would take him to I-95 and eventually Maryland. Jack looked at his watch and scrambled up the steps to his apartment. He grabbed his stuffed duffel bag off the bed, threw it over his shoulder, flicked off the lights, and locked the door in a panic. He took the stairs two at a time and tossed his duffel into the back of his hubcap-less Volvo, then raced to the airport. His unexpected lunch with Brad put him an hour behind schedule and very late for his flight. His cell phone had buzzed 5 times in the last hour. He didn't dare answer it, not with his mind running so fast. He found a spot in the closest lot, which would cost him 3 times as much as the economy lot, but he had no time to catch the tram back to the terminal. A line of Christmas travelers zigzagged back and forth 4 times in front of the United desk. It was an easy 30-minute wait to check in, and Jack didn't have that much time. He walked straight for the front of the line. A gray-haired man waited for the next clerk with his identification in hand and his roller suitcase stacked next to him.
"Excuse me, sir,"
Jack said. His duffel bag was over his shoulder, his Oxford shirt untucked and hanging below his jacket, and his finals week scruff trying to become a beard. An athlete his entire life, he'd always managed to use his tall frame and broad shoulders as tools for comfort rather than intimidation. Today, he'd use his charm and good looks and physique in any way necessary to get on the plane.
"My flight leaves in 20 minutes. Can I please cut in front of you?"
The man looked annoyed, stared at the line behind him, and then motioned for Jack to head to the open counter. "They're already boarding," the ticket agent said. "You might not make it through security and to the gate in time." Jack rolled his finger in a loop to hurry things along.
"I'll try."
"Are you checking bags?"
"Not anymore."
She tapped the keyboard with proficiency and printed the boarding pass. "B6, Terminal 2. I suggest you hurry." Jack grabbed his boarding pass and snaked his way to the front of the security line, raising insults from those he passed.
"My flight's boarding," he told the people who confronted him.
He threw his duffel and shoes onto the conveyor belt, dropped his shaving kit, containing razors, fingernail clippers, and other essential toiletries that would prevent him from making it through security, into the garbage. He made it through the metal detector on the first try, strapped his duffel bag over his shoulder, and ran in his socks to gate B6. The seats outside the gate were empty. "Here he is," the gate agent said to her supervisor, who stood with a passenger list in her hand.
"Sorry,"
he said, raising his shoes as he jogged to the counter. 30 more seconds and the doors were closing.
"Thank you for waiting."
They checked his ID and scanned the boarding pass. 15E, it's a full flight.
"Thanks."
Jack trotted down the skyway, hopping as he pulled on his shoes, and smiled at the flight attendants who waited for him. He pulled his duffel bag from his shoulder and carried it in front of him as he walked down the narrow center aisle of the 737. He ignored the faces of the 100 people who stared at him, concentrating only on the person seated in 15D. He saw her and smiled, and finally sat down with his duffel bag on his lap. "What the hell?" Becca said. "They're about to close the door." "Sir, your bag will have to be stowed under the seat in front of you," the flight attendant told him.
"Sorry."
He shoved the bag under the seat, taking deep breaths. "And you'll need to fasten your seatbelt." Jack smiled at the flight attendant and avoided eye contact with the surrounding passengers who stared at him. He buckled his belt. "What happened?" Becca asked. Jack pointed at his fastened seatbelt and gave a thumbs up to the flight attendant who was presiding over him.
"Tell you later, but I'm gonna need to stop and get a toothbrush before we get to your house."
"Are you that nervous to meet my parents?"
A little nervous, yes. And I need to shave when we land."
Becca took his hand. "They're going to love you."
"They are?"
Jack tried to catch his breath.
"How do you know?"
She kissed his unresponsive lips. "Because I do. Now tell me why you're late."